Special thanks to our friends over at Grades.com for sponsoring this special presentation of post-show recaps, The Haunting of Hill House with Josh Wigler and Antonio Mazzaro. Grades.com is a snack subscription service that delivers delicious, unique snacks to your work or to your home. And Grades wants to show you the tasty side of healthy snacking, and you can try it for yourself for free. Just use the promo code ROB. Grades is a snack service that delivers tasty and nutritious snacks right to your work or your home, and hopefully not your haunted house, because all the snacks come in perfectly portioned packs, great for on the go and treating yourself without overdoing it. From savory combos to flapjacks and cookie dippers, they've got a vast variety of over 100 unique snack creations, which means that there's always something new and different to try. Like, how about the honeycomb flapjack with rusted rolled oat flapjack with honeycomb and chocolate drizzle, or turtle pie, my wife's favorite, raw pecans, vanilla pumpkin seeds, salted caramel milk chocolate, mini cocoa cookies. It is a great way to grab a snack on the go, especially if you are busy in between different work or school projects, and especially also if you are trying to keep an eye on your diet at the start of the new year. When you sign up, browse and rate all the snacks to help Gray's handpick a personalized box to suit your preferences, and each snack is approved by their in-house nutritionist and contains no artificial colors, flavors, or preservatives, so you can feel good about what you're snacking on. So go to Graze.com, G-R-A-Z-E.com now to get a free trial box that includes four of the top-rated and most delicious snacks. Use special code ROB, that's at Graze.com, promo code ROB, for your free box of snacks.
Hey, everybody. What's going on? Josh Wigler here. I am joined once again by the great Antonio Mazzaro. Antonio, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine. I'm a little scared. I'm still a little scared by what we're going to talk about today. It's haunted me through my bones and stayed with me throughout. So I'm excited, but a little bit, little trepidation here on my part.
Yes, yeah? A little trepidation as we are moving into our third podcast in our series of looking back on many of 2018's TV shows in review. A little bit late on this one. My apologies, totally on my end. Some personal stuff over in the Wigglerdom, but we are back here to talk about the show that we promised we would be discussing in our last podcast, and that would be, I might be messing up the pronunciation of this. Is it The Haunting of Hill House?
This runner is one of my least favorite runners.
It's The Haunting of Hill House. We're talking about The Haunting of Hill House on Netflix, and that will be the most unnerving thing to happen to Antonio over the course of this podcast, I hope.
Let's hope so.
Haunting of Hill House, which came out in October. Of course, twas the season for such a scary show. It is a very horrifying, jump scary, unsettling, I don't know, just really, really spooky show. The type of thing that you don't want to watch alone at night unless you are a much braver human being than myself, and I assume Antonio as well.
I watched it at night, but I'm not
in the dark, in like the pitch dark. Did you have a light on, nightlight?
I believe I watched this is true. When I first watched A Haunting of Hill House, I watched maybe 6 or 7 episodes in one day, morning to night. That was an intense Sunday, if I recall.
Wow.
And then on Monday after was a holiday of, maybe it was Veterans Day, I don't remember, but I ended up watching the rest of the series. So I definitely watched some of it at night, but I remember feeling like, I think I'm good to turn in now. Like, I don't think I should keep going on this. This is too much.
How did you sleep?
Well, I went to my bed and put my head on the pillow and
I understand functionally, like your rituals. Are you are you a top sheet guy or no top sheet?
Oh, gotta have the top sheet, my friend. What are you talking about? You're savage if you don't. What are you just going underneath the duvet cover? What are you doing?
A duvet cover is essentially a top sheet, though.
Yeah,
it serves the same function.
Duvet cover is, it's difficult unless you know the burrito method.
The burrito method.
There's a really cool way to put a duvet cover on a comforter. If you don't know the burrito method, maybe look it up on YouTube. It is so easy. Once you learn how to do it, you can put a duvet cover back on your comforter within 30 seconds to a minute. Okay. And I think that's normally a difficult task. No, I'm a top sheet guy. I like the way a top sheet feels against my body. Let's just put it that way.
Okay, we'll leave it there. But you slept soundly that night.
Yeah,
or did you
have top sheets in your guest room. I don't know why you pretend like you're an anti-top sheet guy.
I've slept
on your top sheets or under them.
This is too much information and not the right kind of information for the people who are listening to this podcast.
I didn't sleep well. Haunting of Hill House stuck with me. It still sticks with me. There are times when I think about it and think about moments from it. But the thing is, it is a show, and we're not spoiling anything here. It is a show that is full of absolutely terrifying moments. But it is also a show that focuses on, I think, the elements of fear, the what makes up horror, why we confront the issues we confront and the ways we confront them. And it focuses on ghosts of all different types, not necessarily just the jump out from behind a curtain ghosts, although there are plenty of them in this show. But I think in the first episode, the description is that a ghost can be a lot of things, a memory, a daydream, a secret, grief, anger, guilt. All those things are really, there are moments of all of that in this show. And when it touches on them in such a visceral way with these characters and the people that are portraying them, it sticks with you. So certainly I didn't sleep well, top sheet or not.
Top sheet or not. There were some scenes in this show that are on the list of the scariest moments I've seen committed to film, let alone to film in the last year, just period. And I'd heard a lot of hype about The Haunting of Hill House. I was late to this show. I did not watch it right when it came out. I probably watched it a month or so after the fact. And at that point, it had been heavily hyped for me and the lovely Emily Fox, my wife, who watched this show with me, and she especially. There were some tremendous moments of fright in our neck of the woods.
How did that manifest? What did that look like?
There's one scene, again, not to spoil anything, we're in the spoiler-free section here, but there's one scene late in the season that it's one of the more jump-scary moments. It takes place in a car. Two characters are driving in a car, and then suddenly a third character reveals themselves from the back of the car, and it was a moment where we were watching on our laptop in bed, and Emily and I were kind of idle chatting through the scene, and suddenly the person emerged, and Emily went like, ah!
She screamed like a bird?
Like a bird, like a hawk, like Darren the Hawk, and just absolutely lost her mind. It was tremendous. So it was both scary and greatly amusing in the same breath at point.
Oh, man, that's great.
It was a fun show to watch with a companion, I have to say.
You sleep in the tower, too, so that's even better.
It was like, terrifying.
This is good. Yeah, this
terrifying.
Is a perfectly fitting Hill House metaphor for you guys. Yeah, the show is filled with those moments. That, like I said, there are jump scares. There are hidden ghosts. I don't know if you know about this, Josh, but one of the things the creators of the show did is you'll be looking at a scene, and you'll have watched the show and not seen the hidden ghosts. Like, there'll be characters running down steps, and then if you freeze frame it and you look in the background behind the steps, you'll see just a figure or a face.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of these emergent ghosts, ghosts that you clearly see and watch appear on the screen, but there are a ton of hidden ghosts too. So the show is filled with that kind of scare. But like I said, it's also a show that is really about the emotions associated with all of the things that haunt us, not just the paranormal, but the spiritual, or just the things we carry around with us that bring us fear or bring us the sort of emotions associated with fear. And I think the show does a really deft job of weaving between those two things and showing how those two things are related. And it makes sense because this is a show that is based on a novel, famous novel by Shirley Jackson called The Haunting of Hill House, which is a book that is about very much about ghosts and a ghost story. But it is also about the people that are susceptible or that are haunted by their own issues and how those two things maybe interacting can cause problems. That is something that comes up on this show thematically. But this is not just a book or a show that it is about the things that go bump in the night. It's about the things that go bump in our brains that we kick around, that we deal with, that we try to process, and maybe why we hold on to them or why they enter our lives to begin with. And I think the show does a really deft job of weaving between those two things for sure.
Directed by Mike Flanagan, who is the filmmaker behind a bunch of horror movies, Absentia, Oculus, Hush, Before I Wake. I'm not familiar with his work personally. I don't think that you are either,
no,
Antonio.
Definitely not. I mean, I've heard of a lot of what he's done, but I've not seen it. Specifically, I'd heard of Gerald's Game, which I'm not even sure if he's the director or what his role is on some of these projects. I think he was the director of Gerald's Game, and I've heard of Oculus and Hush, but I've not seen these things. So I didn't come into this movie knowing what to expect. I just knew that this was a product, or this was a property that was in itself a property, the movie property in the house itself, there was a movie that I'd seen when I was a kid called The Haunting. There's a movie from 1999 with Liam Neeson and Catherine Zeta-Jones and Lily Taylor and Owen Wilson called The Haunting. I've seen that, so I don't remember
Owen Wilson being in that. I guess it's been a long time since I've seen it.
It's not, he plays Luke Sanderson. Like, it's not a great, it should be a great role. It's not a great movie, that movie, The Haunting. So I knew about the property, but I didn't know what to expect from the director, for sure.
And he directed every single episode. I mean, multiple episodes with multiple writers, but every single episode, much like one of the other shows that we have discussed here in this 2018 in review series, Homecoming, as Sam Esmail directed every single one of those. Mike Flanagan directed every single episode of The Haunting of Hill House, and a really, really impressive job. You know, there's some stuff that I'm sure we'll get into it, that there's one episode in particular that I think everybody has lost their minds over in a way that I really just didn't. But even from a technical perspective, I have to respect what was done on that episode. For those who are in the know, that's Two Storms, episode 6. It's just a really, really impressive filmmaker with such a clear sense of vision, juggling so many stories. This is a show that is told across multiple points in time, so there's a lot of story material to keep track of. There's essentially two full casts to be reining in and wrangling here, and really just a very deft job by Mike Flanagan, who is not just directing the show, but is show running as well. Just really, you know, you got to tip your hat, your bowler cap even. I know, God, that is, there are some scary freaking ghosts here, but bowler hat, man's got to be pretty much number one on the list for me.
Yeah, terrifying. And you're right about the deafness. You're right about the work that went into this. And the two casts are part of this from a non-spoiler perspective, just setting up the story. What you've got essentially is a story about a young family who has moved into a house. I believe it's in the Berkshires. Maybe this is part of the Emily Fox fear. I believe it's in Western Massachusetts.
I believe so as well. Yeah,
that I think is the source. It runs with the source material, generally speaking, that you're talking about a Massachusetts-based allegedly haunted house. Although I'm not sure that the family that moves into this house knows the history of it. They are moving in to rehab the house and flip it and then make it to their dream house. But unfortunately, as they're living in this house, they are experiencing some horrible stuff. You even see in the first episode that some great horror went down in this house. And the family that you're seeing 20 years later, I should say, is still reeling from the effects of whatever happened that horrible night in Hill House. And so what you see throughout the series is you see some of what's happened in the past and some of what's happening in the present. And you see those stories just being cut together, and you're learning more about what happened in the past gradually through these stories. It doesn't proceed in a linear fashion. Sometimes we go back over the same territory from a different character's point of view. The first 5 episodes of the series are really bottle episodes in a way. Not bottle episodes, but let's just say they're limited to one character's main point of
view. Near and dear to my lost loving heart, where it's very, very similar in that structure of you've got a Jack flashback, you've got a Sawyer flashback. You've got very similar, similar storytelling structure here with at least the first several episodes of the series.
Right. Because what they've done in the Haunting of Hill House book is not that. The Haunting of Hill House book is a paranormal investigator has brought with him two people and a member of the family who owns the house, a younger member of the family who owns the house, and they interact with the caretakers of the house. They know the house to be haunted, and they're investigating exactly how it's haunted and what that looks like. Those characters that are part of that each have their own attributes. Some are, there's maybe like a libertine, like a free-spirited woman. There's a woman who's very troubled, and the young male character is a drunk, and he's sort of a very party-oriented guy, and you've got the doctor. And they've taken in the Netflix show a lot of the characteristics of these characters, and they've placed them onto what ultimately is this family of people. And the family of people is made up of multiple children. You've got five kids in total, and the two parents. So you obviously, as you're going through the first five episodes, are getting a point of view of each of the five children, what it was like for them to live in Hill House in the past, and then what that means for what they're dealing with in the present. One is a funeral director. One is a psychologist or a psychiatrist, some kind of brain doctor, but is struggling with maybe her own issues. One is a writer who has written about the family's experiences with Hill House, and maybe has taken some liberties and has perhaps in some ways isolated himself from the family as a result of his actions. One is clearly struggling with whatever happened at Hill House. He is a heroin addict, which is certainly all the vogue in TV nowadays, as is reflecting of our modern times. And then one is a younger woman who also seems to be, she is the twin of the heroin addict, and they seem to have been the youngest children at Hill House, and thus the most affected by whatever went on there. And so she is struggling as well. And so we really see throughout the first five episodes what their experiences at Hill House were like and what that means for them as in the current realm. And then the show's a 10-episode series, so the second half of the season really builds upon everything that happened in the first five episodes. And episode six is the episode you talked about. That's a technical marvel. And then the final three episodes are sort of a race to the finish. I really think the way the show is structured, enough can't be said about how fantastically it handled the story and how it weaves all of these character narratives with each other. It builds this quilt that we then watch unravel through the rest of the season.
Yeah, and I think much like we talked about with Homecoming, we talked about with Maniac, and we're looking at a similar deal here with Haunting of Hill House. While Homecoming is getting a second season, we've talked about the possibility of could it be a very different story than the first season of that show. Maniac, there are no plans for a second season of Maniac. I'm curious what the future of the Haunting of Hill House is going to be. I do not believe that there has been any news of a second season of The Haunting of Hill House. And again, without spoiling what happens in the story, I will say this strikes me as a very self-contained story. Yeah. That I cannot imagine the stories of the people that we are meeting within the context of this first season of the show would continue in any capacity. In fact, Netflix is going to have a very similar show in its roster fairly soon, Lock and Key, which is based on one of my very favorite comic book series of all time.
Oh, yeah, I didn't know they were doing that.
Yeah, they are.
So did they take the pilot that was created and are they repurposing it? Or?
No. Lock and Key has been through quite the adventure. I believe two pilots have been produced for that show in addition to the third for Netflix. Netflix ordered a straight-to-series adaptation of Lock and Key, which is a very similar story to Haunting of Hill House. It's got a haunted house structure. It's got a family that has gone through a trauma and is now dealing with a very traumatic situation inside of a haunted house. It is written by Joe Hill, who is the son of Stephen King, so it's got that Kingian sensibility. Joe Hill, who did not even take daddy's name, does not need the Stephen King trademark to knock out some really incredible stories. Really one of the best comic books I've ever read, and I cannot encourage it more. Gabriel Rodriguez is the artist. He's incredible. I really don't know how they're going to do a show of that, but I think once they have Lock and Key, if Lock and Key is as good on Netflix as it is in comic book form, there's really going to be no need to do another season of The Haunting of Hill House. So for right now, at the very least, and very likely for moving forward, this is a 10-episode slice of television that is really freaking good and tells a really, really strong, scary, moving, complete story all in the span of 10 episodes. So as we've been doing here in this series of when we're making these recommendations for these shows, I think for me, one of the strong selling points of The Haunting of Hill House is you're devoting about 10 hours of your life to this, and that's going to be it.
Yeah, and I think that's all it should be, for sure, for all the reasons you said, not least of which is lock and key. But also, I think it's rather in keeping with Shirley Jackson. The TV series changes significantly her work. It is inspired by, it is not a direct adaptation. As I already described, the family structure changes it significantly, but it lifts a lot. It borrows a lot. Direct
story,
dialogue.
How about the story beats? Are they fairly similar?
No. There are similar story beats, which we'll talk about, but generally speaking, no. But Shirley Jackson herself, this is her best known work, and she died young. She died at age 48. And since she died, she's got a lot of short stories that are out there. She has a couple of other novels, but she never really wrote anything that was a follow up to Hill House or anything really in that realm. She did have a psychological horror story. She's had some other things that she's done, and she's written some gothic mystery novels and things like that, but she hasn't. So there are things you could adapt. Maybe you want to throw some of these people at some of her work, but she did not revisit Hill House in any meaningful way. And I think that would be wrong to continue to revisit a thing beyond what we're doing here with the Shirley Jackson stuff. And we can get into that more when we talk about spoilers, but I think it would be very much in keeping with in honoring her not to do more of Hill House, because she certainly didn't revisit it that I know of. And so I think it makes sense that we ended here, but I'm all for this creator and the team that put this great show together doing more for Netflix in a similar vein. It'll be interesting to see what the follow-up, if any, is.
Anything else you want to talk about in the non-spoiler section? I'm really eager to just kind of get into the plot, unless you've got anything that you feel like we need to set up.
I just want to say, we already said it. It's a scary show.
Scary.
I ranted yes, a lot about Maniac when we podcasted about it, and people watching the trailer and thinking this might not be for me, whatever. Give that a chance. But if you're not the kind of person that can do the scary movies or the scary shows, even though this is a fantastic show, there's just no way, like the
it's
barrier
so
is too great. The barrier is too great. It is horrifying at times, so yeah. You certainly, not that you need it, but you certainly have my permission to just listen and continue to listen and spoil the hell out of yourself if you want to do that without watching the thing. But if you're at all inclined, please do take the time. I think it will be greatly worth it to watch the show, for sure.
I guess the other thing that I would say too is just there's a lot of really great actors involved in the show.
We didn't really talk about that.
Henry Thomas, E.T. Phone Home. Very, very great to see him here on Hill House. Carla Gugino, who is an actor that I have loved forever. I think that she's fantastic. Dario Naharis in a much more buttoned up way. Michael Huseman is going to be playing the oldest son in the family, Stephen Crane, who is such a derp. Oh my God.
You hate Steven.
I hate Steven, but we'll get into all of that in the spoiler section. And the people who play the kids, I think that the child casting especially is just remarkable. Young Luke is one for the ages, as far as I'm
concerned.
I know
you love Julian Hillier just because you see yourself in him. So
I feel like the new Jonathan Lipnicki for a new generation.
I'm a big fan of Timothy Hutton, massive fan of Timothy Hutton. I love the TV show Leverage, and I think that he is an underrated guy. If you want to go all the way back to some of his greatest work, Academy Award level work, in Ordinary People in 1980, but then if you want to just watch Leverage, like that is, as far as procedural type shows go, it's a fantastic one, underrated show, and he was so good on it. And so I love seeing him in this show, and I think that he, as the elder Hugh Crane, as the elder patriarch of the family, he doesn't get enough love anywhere. So I love seeing him in this role. Really good casting, because he can play a troubled guy. And certainly Hugh Crane is not without his troubles in this show. So I love seeing him, for sure.
The only thing that I thought was really funny about that is that he plays the older version of Hugh Crane, and Henry Thomas plays the younger version of Hugh Crane. And they are separated by about 26 years of distance in time in the context of the show, yet the two men are separated by 11 years of life.
I thought you were going to say they were separated by 26 seconds of life.
What are you trying to say about either one of these guys? Just like, you know, it seems a little mean-spirited, like a backhanded compliment.
Well, I think there's something else crazy in this show about that. I can't remember what it is, but one of the people, I think it's that, that Carla Gugino, who plays the mother, Olivia Crane, I think she played the sister of one of the people who plays the elder siblings in this show. I can't remember exactly where that's from, but I have a feeling, I think there's another one of those weird connections like that in this show where somebody has played the sister, the younger sister of somebody she's now the mother of the
younger
kid.
That's very funny.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. There's amazing. A lot of that here with the passing of the years for sure.
Got it. All right. Well, we're going to get into spoilers now. Run away. If you have not yet seen The Haunting of Hill House and you want to go into it fully cold, fully unspoiled, I strongly advise that. I don't think that this is a show that's going to be as effective if you see all the twists and turns coming along the way. One in particular that really knocked me out. Maybe I should have seen it coming. I should have been smarter. I did not see it coming. And it was such a head spinner, literally in the case of this character. So we're going to get into all of that stuff right now. Hopefully that's enough buffer for you to turn off your phones. Antonio, I'm obviously talking about the bent neck lady.
Oh my God.
That was a great reveal. The bent neck lady. One of the best episodes of television of 2018, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. Maybe the best horror film of 2018. I'm curious if there's a better one.
Teddy Perkins was this year.
Teddy Perkins was also excellent. And in a similar way, I think, So both of those are real standouts and really about haunted houses and the things that haunt us about them and why we keep ourselves in them. And certainly the bent neck lady. I did not see that twist coming either. So it was a real home run for me and just a shocking moment of television and just such a well-delivered episode. Like the emotions by 15 minutes into that episode, the unfortunate story of what happens with Nell, who we've seen her go from the family at the house to having her sleep paralysis problems because probably of the bent neck lady, to going to a sleep study, to getting married to her sleep study doctor, to seeing the sleep study doctor die of an aneurysm in front of her while she was paralyzed, to seeing Dr. Montague, which, by the way, was the name of the doctor in the novel Hill House. So, and I believe also played by the guy who played Luke in the original Haunting. So there's all this shared DNA here. But we see all this within the first 17 minutes of the episode. And it's crazy. That is a really rough and great episode for sure.
And she was the bent neck lady the whole time.
She was the bent neck lady the whole time.
She was always her. I don't understand the time loops. Another lost connection.
Preconceiving her own demise, and maybe you could argue fated for her own demise. Like she just the fear of it is ultimately what led to it. This is a theme that is very prevalent throughout the novel, where we have the character of Eleanor, or Nell, who is somebody who has had a rough go of it in her life and who goes to Hill House, maybe wanting to find herself, and becomes ultimately the victim of Hill House. And she is the one the house is reaching out to. She is the one they're writing on the wall, "Come home, Nell," just like in this TV show. And she is ultimately the one who the house claims, in a way that it only the house can. And so the story of Eleanor in the TV show is very much like the story of Eleanor in the novel. And this thematic idea that maybe whatever your problems are, Hill House exacerbates them and will put you in a position where they become who you are. They define who you are. We saw that happen in the TV show with the mother, with ultimately what happens with Olivia Crane. We see that play out with her, where she has some underlying issue and she goes to Hill House and it's incredibly exacerbated. There's that fantastic monologue in episode 7 that Mr. Dudley, the caretaker, gives, where he's like basically saying, like, your wife maybe needs to take a little bit of a break from this house. And he tells a story about what's happened with other women at this house or with other people at this house, including why his own family doesn't spend time at this house at night. And it's because there are things in the house which play into whatever your inner psychological torment are. It's fascinating because the house rewards as well. There is the red room, Josh, which is the room of requirement that just gives you kind of whatever you want. but it also takes away. It also exacerbates whatever darkness is within you. It's a fascinating house for sure.
It really is. And there's just a lot. There's you mentioned the Dudley monologue, and without getting like into a specific one, I do think that ended up being one of the unexpected delights of this show, where there's just a lot of moments like that. There's a lot of moments where the actors are just being allowed to really just show off. That monologue in specific is the one that stands out to me the most, when Horace is talking about all the atrocities that occurred here, and the camera's just never once breaking away from the actor Robert Longstreet. It's such an unflinching, juicy moment for an actor. I got to imagine that is a career highlight for that guy.
Yeah, it's so, you know, good.
It's such a great scene. Or even like a lot of like the moments with Nell, specifically that final monologue that she gets to deliver towards the end of the series, when she's finally able to have this moment alone with her siblings, who can now see her in this state, sort of a Blade Runner-esque. It felt like to me, like the whole like tears
like rain.
Yeah, exactly.
I've seen things. Yeah.
There's just a lot of great character moments in here that I kind of didn't expect. One of the things that I'd been hearing about Hill House before I hopped into it was a lot of the reactions were like, I really hate these characters. Like a lot of people who I trust, who had watched the show or were starting to watch the show, is like, is this going to get any better? I really don't like the cast, and I really don't like these people, and I hope that they all get ravaged by ghosts. So it's like, whoa, I don't know if that's a show that I necessarily want to watch. But I do think that part of the journey of The Haunting of Hill House, at least as I experienced it, was seeing a lot of these damaged people who are in many ways very unlikable, many of them, if not the majority of them, and finding out why that's the case, and why these are people who are so closed off. Why is Steven such a jerk? Why was Nell as damaged as she was? You know, why is Shirley so uptight? All of these different things, and they are very unpleasant to deal with in their modern day context for, I really do think, the vast majority of the show. To the point that when we got to the season finale, and we get to the point where like Luke has apparently overdosed and has died from an overdose, it looks like at first, like I really thought that we were going to be getting an ending where everybody dies and the moral of the story is your sins will eat you alive. And I thought that that's what we were being set up for. And then there's just sort of this beautiful counterpoint by the end of it of like, if you can confront these demons, you can survive them. That like, if you don't let them define you, you can move on. But I don't know that that works as well if you don't dislike many of these characters for a vast majority of the show.
Yeah, that's why I'm interested to hear that you're so out on Steven, because the story is very much,
I think it's a good arc. I do.
Yeah, it's an arc for that, right? And I think you're right. By the 10th episode, you're in the place you're in that you were just describing. And I think the ending is certainly controversial on many levels. The whatever walked in Hill House walked alone, that is stated at the beginning of the show, read by Steven, direct lift from Shirley Jackson's novel, and the story is framed in a little bit in that respect. But by the end of the season, whatever walked there walked together is what Steven said. And I think that fits a lot more with the familial connections that were established and developed throughout the TV show. But it is a significant change from the Shirley Jackson novel, and I understand a controversial one. I think the ending in and of itself is unexpected and a little bit controversial. It certainly is very, very almost too sweet in a way. It's probably the happiest ending we could get. But I personally loved it, and I think you did too, if I recall.
No, I really enjoyed it. I know our great friend Mike Bloom, he covered this show for The Hollywood Reporter and got a chance to speak with Mike Flanagan about a lot of what went on in the preparation for this show, the deviations from the book, and that apparently the ending of his adaptation of The Haunting of Hill House, that the way that it ended with this final shot of the family gathered together, where they've put a lot of their baggage behind them and they're rallying behind Luke, and they're, you know, he seems like he's turned the corner
2 years, right?
Yeah. And everyone's like behind him at this point, that there was an original version of the ending where the Red Room door was going to be present. And so there was going to, at the very least, be a possible interpretation, if not an overt, declaration that this was not really happening and that the cranes were still stuck inside of Hill House and were now living inside of the house, and the house had won. But there's no sign of the Red Room door at all in the version that they went with. And I think the idea was, I think it was a late addition, a late idea to deviate from that. And Mike Flanagan basically deciding like, it was just too much. It was too mean for them to have that happen. This is the exact quote that he gives to Mike Bloom. He says, "We toyed with the idea for a little while that over that final monologue, over the image of the family together, we would put the Red Room window in the background. For a while, that was the plan. Maybe they never really got out of that room. The night before it became time to shoot it, I sat up in bed and I felt guilty about it. I felt like it was
haunted."
Cool.
He's haunted.
He said, "I felt like it was cruel, and that surprised me. I'd come to love the characters so much that I wanted them to be happy. I came into work and said, I don't want to put the window up. I think it's mean and unfair. Once that gear had kicked in, I wanted to lean as far in that direction as possible. We've been on this journey for 10 hours. A few minutes of hope was important to me."
Well, it's nice to know that the creators of these things have hearts and have pulses and souls. Yeah, not always, because a lot of times they torture, or in the case of, and I don't want to spoil another show, but there was a another big show on HBO in this year that had an ending that I thought made me angry, like viscerally angry, the way that they chose to end that show. And it was another like familial haunted drama with a great cast. So I don't want to spoil anything more, but I think that it's nice to know that there was some thought put into that. The window, by the way, is the consistent thing throughout all iterations of the Red Room. If you look at it, if the Red Room is a treehouse, the window's in the back. The toy room, you can see the window. The dance studio, the game room, the family room, the reading room, whatever it is you see when we have that final monologue explaining what it is, we see the window present throughout. So that window would have been a visual clue, and it would have been unfortunate for sure. We don't need an Inception ending and everything. Sometimes the ending is good the way it is. But I do understand that there was some controversy in the way this ending landed. Personally, for me, I thought it was great. By the way, I looked it up. Carla Gugino plays the mother of young Theo in this series. However, it's Kate Siegel playing the older Theo in the series was the mother of Carla Gugino in Gerald's Game. So
that's very funny.
Interesting. That's like that plays out that way. This guy, Mike Flanagan, I'm given to understand that he uses a lot of the same people in his projects, which I appreciate. He works with a lot of the same people. So some of these people that were present in Haunting of Hill House are people that he worked with on Gerald's Game and probably in other projects as well. And I think that's neat that this is a project where certainly the idea, you hear a lot about actors who get into characters and get into roles, and certainly the role of Luke Sanderson is one of them, where what is that poor kid like? Does he know, like, not just the heroin addict version, which there's got to be demons and ghosts you carry with you if you're getting deep into that character, but what about the poor kid? Like, does he know that he's being scared by ghosts, or is that all just green screen and he's told to just say what's going on and act scared? Like, that's the sort of thing I
wondered
about
that too. I wondered about, like, what was the process like of making this show for the young cast, and especially for Julian Hilliard, who plays young Luke, and for McKenna Grace, who plays young Theo, and Violet McGraw, who plays young Nell. Like, this is all stuff that I wondered, because they're so cute, they're so adorable, they're so innocent, and they're just being savaged by ghosts in the context of the show.
Horrible.
And I hope that they were all just like having a blast making this thing, because the idea of them like walking away from making the show and just being like utterly ruined is unfathomable to me.
Well, imagine
the great horror on its own.
Imagine being that age and not being able to watch back what you've done, right? Yeah. Like, holy shit, what was going on there? Like, no way. Yeah. Like, I don't want to watch that. So
the scene with young Luke in the dumbwaiter, by the way, in the dumbwaiter elevator and going like to the sub basement of Hill House was probably the most scared I have been in 2018 by any work of fiction. Even knowing that he would survive it and would, you know, go on to be an adult, I was like, oh God, the bowler hat man is going to show up and force young Luke to take heroin right now. Like, that's exactly what we're that's exactly what we're headed for, and I am not here for it.
Who knew the bowler hat guy was a drug dealer?
Yeah. What do you think he has in his hat? Why he's always
samples and testers? This is rough.
That's why he's looking for it.
Yeah, no, this is bad. I don't like that one bit. Yeah, I...
Did you know that the bowler hat man is played by an actor named Fedor Steer? So close to Fedora Steer.
Is that true?
Yes, according to Wikipedia, that is true. How about that?
Theodora Steer?
No, Fedora Steer.
Fedora Steer?
It's a real missed opportunity to not add that A to the end of his name. F-E-D-O-R. Should just go for it. Be Fedora.
His IMDb bio, it says Fedor Steer, originally Dutch Canadian. Well, what the hell is he now?
He's changed. Now, ghost.
He credits a chance encounter with Joseph Gordon-Levitt and his family on a cruise ship for piquing his interest in acting.
That's an incredible backstory.
Oh man, I'm scared. I really am scared of the bowler hat man. Like that is a great ghost.
Uncool that exists. I'm not happy about it. I'm very upset about it. How he's levitating and tapping the floor,
sliding down the halls.
It's not okay. It's unfair and it's not cool.
The bent neck lady, also terrifying. The flapper lady, that was a pretty interesting one that's introduced late in the series. And she convinces Olivia Crane to do what she does. Ultimately, horrifying stuff. What did you think of the twist? Speaking of what Olivia Crane ultimately does, what did you think of the twist with what we thought was a ghost with Abigail and ultimately not being a ghost? Well, at least not until she was made a ghost by what Olivia Crane did.
I was very upset by it. And I think that I wasn't fooled by it. Like, I didn't think that she was a ghost in that moment. When she starts convulsing, when she's the first one to be sick and die. Like,
did you
I didn't think
she was a ghost throughout the show, though? Like, every time she would pop up or when
probably
Luke would talk about her and say, can I have a sleepover? You know, and then she was just there all of a sudden.
Yeah, I think that plays really well. I think for me, like the full horror of Olivia's transformation wasn't going to work without some sort of really atrocious act that she commits. So when Abigail starts convulsing during the tea party, for me, I felt like, oh God, that's got to be real. Like that has to have actually happened. And it would make a lot of sense from that moment onward then why the Dudleys would still be involved in the house and why Hugh would have said, like, I want to bequeath the house to them. I want to make sure no one can touch it and that they get it forever. Like those things started adding up. But I think through most of the run of the show, it was never really a thought on my mind that maybe she was real. I think you're kind of groomed to assume that Luke is seeing yet another ghost, as there are so many in the house.
Yeah, the girl Olive Abercrombie, who plays Abigail, she looks like a ghost. No offense to her. I don't know if she ever went on a cruise with Joseph Gordon-Levitt or what got her into acting, but she really does look ghastly. She's got that really stark pale skin and that haircut. She definitely looks ghastly. She's got those big ghost eyes.
They do a really good job of setting that up, like making her look like she's never seen like the cold light of day. Like they really make you feel like she would fit in seamlessly with the other ghosts here. And really what that ends up being is like the isolated life that she's living with her parents on this haunted compound that, of course she would grow up being like deeply frightened by stuff.
Yeah, and an outsider to the world, really, and interested in what's going on with the family there. It all fits. And I thought the caretakers were great. I thought the Dudleys were great. The Dudleys are characters in the novel. And I think maybe if you want to say perhaps among the more faithful adaptations, we get a lot more Dudley in the TV series than we do in the novel. But they are the caretakers who know more about the house, who probably are scared of the house, who know to stay out of the house at night. All of that is right there from the novel. So I thought they were great. And like you mentioned earlier about Robert Longstreet, his monologue, one of the highlights of the series for me is that monologue. And there are a lot of great monologues throughout the show. I think that is definitely a hallmark of what they were doing here. are those extended monologues or those extended takes. And I think I had read something the creator had said about this, that Flanagan was talking about when he was shooting this. He's a little concerned because from an audience standpoint, it might be easier to not pay attention when just one character is speaking, but you have to put a lot of faith and trust in your actors, and you have to do subtle things like maybe the camera subtly pushes in on them while they're speaking to draw you into the story.
Yeah.
But that was something that he wanted to bring into this show. And I think he did to great effect. Certainly your mileage may vary, Josh, about these extended takes. I know you and I have differing opinions on episode 6, which is certainly where the extended takes are put front and center in this show.
Yeah, I think if we had been talking closer to the time that I watched the show in the first run and binged through the show, I would have been a little sharper as to why I really didn't love Two Storms, at least not the way that everybody seemed to really go gaga about it. Again, like I got a lot of like preconceptions heading into Hill House from people who had watched it, and I kept hearing about, oh, there's the one-off episode, there's the episode that's just one take, it's so good. And I think that I'm just a little cold on the one take episode at this point. I just feel like it's happening a lot right now on TV. There's really got to be a really good reason for it right now for it to keep going. Like Sam Esmail nailed that. Like we don't need to just be seeing that every single other show. And I know that that's a wild exaggeration, but it just felt a little needless to me. And then some of the bickering back and forth between the cast members, I felt like that was material you could probably get to in a cleaner way than what felt to me like a one-off episode, like a one-er episode for the sake of having a one-er episode in the arsenal of Hill House.
I understand
that I'm basically on an island with that take. It did not land with me nearly as well as some of the other moments in the series and some of the other episodes. And especially coming off of the bent neck lady, which I thought was the high mark of the whole show. This is the very next episode, and I think Bent Neck Lady is such a tough act to follow, and it just didn't measure up for me. So maybe it's just a matter of my own expectations going into it.
I liked it in the Long Night of the Soul element of it, where all the characters are really processing what's happened. And I like how it mixed the horror with the grief. And I like that it did so in a way that felt like a staged play. And I understand that that maybe is the same thing that you don't like about it.
Yeah, but I didn't love that aspect.
Yeah, but I like that about it because I think what you're dealing with in this show throughout is you're dealing with that dichotomy or that struggle between the jump scares and the scares of the horror that you're seeing with the bowler hat guy or with the bent neck lady and the actual grief and the ghost that these characters are carrying around with them, the adult characters specifically, and that juxtaposition of the actual horrors that they experience when they're in the house and the memories and the echoes of the horrors and the ghosts that they've created in their lives as a result of what happened in that house that you're seeing them carry with them throughout the adults. I think that is what is smashed together in this episode most directly. I think more directly than any other episode for me, because all the characters are front and center. As I said, those first 5 episodes, they do feature all the characters, but normally they're one character at the front and center of the episode, and you're seeing some of the other characters throughout. But this is a showpiece for all of them, and it's called Two Storms, right? Because there's the storm in the past, where there's this night at the house that this all was happening, and there's the storm in the present, where you're dealing with Nell's layout and the storm that's happening there.
Right.
And you're seeing the father come into the story with the adults for the first time. He's in the room with the other adults for the first time in the present telling of the story. I thought that was just really effective in terms of letting each of these characters process their individual moments, but also collectively dealing with them in the room with each other. And I think they're just little character moments, how each of them process approaching the casket differently, and what that looks like for each of them and what that feels like for each of them. I think because you're not cutting away and because you're lingering, it has a lot of significance. I also thought there was a really cool moment where, you know, the camera has swirled around the room in that layout room, and we've seen the coffin, and then we see Nell's ghost in the background when it moves around. There are moments like that in the episode I thought really worked for me. So I understand.
Yeah, I think from a filmmaking perspective, I have almost no complaints about it. I think it's very impressive. I think that, you know, the moments where you see Nell in like bent neck lady mode in the background suddenly, and you just wonder like, how did you guys pull that off? Like, yeah. What was like the, how much running around needed to occur? Like, how many like sweaty takes of getting Victoria Pedretti out of the coffin and into bent neck lady mode? Like, how did you pull that off? You know, it's that stuff is very impressive to me. I just felt like maybe there was a better way to tell this particular story. I felt like some of the acting seams were showing for me. There's a lot of great actors on this show, and even the ones that I didn't love in this scene, I think are very talented people. But there's just a lot of like the Shirley stuff really wasn't registering well for me. I'm not a big fan of her husband as a character. I didn't love Kevin, and like the whole, like, you know that it's going to come out that he's been taking the book money. And then everything in like the basement of like Kevin making out with Theo and Shirley catching it. Like, there was just, it was a little soap opera-y for me.
Yeah,
in some of the reveals of the, episode.
I get it for sure. And anytime you do like a technical Marvel episode, the question becomes like, is the juice worth the squeeze? And did we need to do it this way? They shut down production for 6 weeks to pull this off. And while it's certainly, like you talked about, a significant and impressive technical performance, and I think for me, what the extended takes do, and the first one I really remember is in Children of Men. And there's a extended sequence in that movie where it's super intense. I mean, the camera's being shot at, really. The characters that are following the camera are being shot at. And when ultimately it cuts away, I mean, I think the first time I watched it, I like gasped like tears down, because it was, you're used to those moments. Like, you're used to the emotion being taken out by these cuts, like cut away, cut away, cut away. And so you don't have the build that forms when you don't cut away. I think that when you're talking about these extended takes, building that, like the extended take, the monologue that we've talked about a lot from Mr. Dudley, there are edits at the beginning of that, back and forth to Henry Thomas, just standing there. And then eventually it is one longer take. And I think,
right.
I think there's a lot to be said for building emotion through these longer takes and not letting the audience have the relief of moving around within the scene and cutting away, that you're a character in this and you're watching this all play out. The camera is an observer and you're not like, you know, shifting around. You're taking it all in. Some of that, I think the first 17 minutes or whatever, I think that's what works best. When you're talking about going down into the basement and stuff like that, that doesn't work as well for me in this episode for sure. So I think the first 17 minutes, when characters are arriving and when they're all dealing with everything differently, that's when this episode worked best for me. But I still think maybe episode 5 is the best episode, totally, especially with the reveal at the end of the bent neck lady. It's just so
good. It's just so horrible, because you know, at this point, you know, the premise of the show, I mean, at the end of the first episode, is that Nell is dead and Steven, who's never seen a ghost before, finally sees a ghost in the form of his dead sister. And so that's like a real, you know, a real bang type of moment. But you come to really appreciate Nell as a character and not just as a plot device in the episodes building up to that, but especially in the bent neck lady, in that whole episode. It's just such a good showcase for the character. It's such a good showcase for Victoria Pedretti as an actress. And you know that it is going to have this very sad ending, even in the moments where she's like dancing with the ghost of Arthur, like dancing with the ghost of her husband. And like, you're now recontextualizing those scenes from the first episode of her just like kind of like traipsing around through the house by herself in that dress. You know this is going to end poorly. You don't know that it's going to end with her as the bent neck lady.
Right.
But like, just the journey of that, I think, is the journey of Hill House consolidated. I think that the entire arc of the whole season, of the whole series, hopefully, of, you know, being put through your paces and being put through traumatic horror at almost every turn, and coming to this place of like emotional relief followed by more despair. I think so much of that's on display throughout the whole show, with the exception of those final moments of relief, as Mike Flanagan explains it, the final scene of the whole show to Mike Bloom. I feel like all of that is really on display in this one episode, that it is the showcase for The Haunting of Hill House, and by far and away the slam dunk episode of the series for me.
Yeah. And it's great, I think, that the show is able to do that in the fifth episode, because it really, as you're pointing out, like, you know, things are going to go bad for Nell. You know, they did go bad for Nell. You don't necessarily know how or why. And what you find out through those first four episodes is maybe what was going on with these other characters while all of that was happening. And you're also learning a lot about what happened to them when they were kids, so that when you get to the fifth episode, you've seen and heard about the bent neck lady a ton. She's one of the first ghosts that's mentioned in the show, right, in the pilot episode. So this is something that's been present, as has the foreboding sense of something bad happening to Nell. You find out at the end of the pilot that Nell has died. Steven sees her ghost in his apartment in the end of that first episode. So all of that is set up, and it builds to this fifth episode in such a fantastic way, such that the fifth episode is able to stand on its own as a great piece of television, but it also treads so perfectly on everything that was set up before it. It really is really well delivered and well paced, those first five episodes. And really, I think you get the sixth episode then, which is its own piece. And then, as I said, 7, 8, 9, 10 are Luke leaves the funeral and goes right out to wherever he's going. We think he's going to the house, and we have the 10th episode being what it is and the 9th episode being what it is. So I think it's a really well-structured show. I think they did an excellent job with that. As I said, a significant change from the book, but thematically on point, I think. And it's a book that I only really read after the TV show, and right, maybe because we were going to podcast, but it is a book that I'm not sure if it had been a beloved book of mine, if I would have felt the same way about the changes. But to me, the changes are really resonant. Like the ideas and the themes of the novel and what causes people to have problems in the novel at Hill House, they're really resonant and really just like right on point with what causes people to have problems in the TV show of Hill House and what it ultimately does. I actually think the weakest part of the adaptation was, I think the interior of the house is spectacular. They built a two-story walkable set on a soundstage. So that is a house they built in a soundstage. I think the exterior left a little bit to be desired. The Hill House that's described in the book is nestled into the hills, and you have this long drive on the way up, and you can see it before you're ever there. I didn't think that was accomplished as well in the TV show. The sense of place of where the house was nestled into these hills and how isolated it truly was, that wasn't something that I felt was as accomplished on the TV show. And maybe you don't need it, but that was one thing I felt was different for sure, and maybe lacking a little bit in the TV adaptation. We just got mostly the same exterior shot where sometimes you would see lights on in the house when a character pulled up. But I didn't think we had
a little bit of mist at the gates outside.
Yeah, whatever it is, we didn't ultimately achieve it the same way that I would have liked. But other than that,
you think about like the iconic haunted houses, like you can picture the Overlook Hotel. I can't really picture the Hill House Manor as depicted on this show. Like when I'm closing my eyes and like I'm thinking about it from the outside, like I can see it from the gate level distance, but I don't see like the specific structure. You know what I mean? Like I feel like it's a little forgettable from the outside. I think you're totally right. But internally, I think that they did a really good job of creating this space that's just kind of going to like swarm your nightmares for at least a day or two after you watch the show.
Yeah, certainly at least a day or two. I mean, there are so many horrible moments, just jump scare moments where, like, for example, when Steven sees the ghost of Nell in his apartment and she is looking at him and then she's horrible. Not said anything. Yeah. Opens her screaming mouth, right? Horrifying. Like there are a lot of horrifying moments like that in this show, to be fair. But I think the show really does deliver on what it sets up in terms of what the ghosts can be. And Steven says at one point, most of the time, a ghost is a wish. And I think that's an interesting thing to think about as you watch the show. Did the show accomplish that? Is a ghost a wish? How did you feel about, this is the one I think maybe a little bit of a whiff for me, Shirley's ghost, the man holding up the drink at the bar. Did you feel like that was on the same level with the other ghosts that we saw throughout the series?
I think it was a different type of horror. You know, I think like that marital domestic horror, was, you know, that we're not really seeing that. We're seeing that in the Steven story. It was probably the weakest. I think pretty easily the weakest of those final ghosts that's closing in on everybody. It comes pretty late in the series too. It feels like there isn't a ton that's cluing you in to this being a part of Shirley's story.
Yeah, I think as you're watching it, you probably are like, "Well, she had a paranormal experience. That guy's dead." No, it's just a piece of guilt that she's carrying with her.
Right.
You're right. Like the domestic horror story is portrayed with Stephen as well, but it makes sense. Like on some level, I get it, and I think it works. It felt a little bit different. Like it felt like so much of the rest of the show had this supernatural aspect to it, and Stephen's ghost was very much present in terms of the way he treated his relationship, but it was because of what happened in the past. And I'm not sure I felt the through line as much with Shirley. I just feel like maybe it's just the thing where I don't like the character of her husband and the drama there as much. Like maybe it just doesn't, because of the stakes of the rest of the show, maybe those stakes don't feel as significant to me.
Sure.
I don't know.
I feel the same.
I don't know. The issue with Stephen is of course, he doesn't just have the problem with his wife. His problem is in general that he's pushed himself away from the people that are closest to him, I think in part because of what happened to him when he was a kid. And that's the arc we see play out throughout the show. So it feels different than maybe the Shirley stuff just doesn't land as well for me. Did you catch, by the way, at one point when Steven goes and visits young Luke in the treehouse, which by the way, I think Steven is the only character that is ever in the Red Room when it's another kind of room with any other character. I think he is seen a couple times entering the Red Room with other characters, and we don't all ever see other characters in the room together.
And the idea there probably being that, like, no, Steven, you were seeing a lot more ghosts than you realize.
Exactly.
Not only did you see, you know, you've lived your life thinking that you've never seen a ghost, you've seen a fairly sizable amount of ghostly activity.
And he's the oldest, so he was a little bit of an anchor in a way that he maybe never wanted to take responsibility for. And that's a source of drama in the present day, when he doesn't want to take responsibility for Nell or Luke in the way that maybe he should, or in the way that Shirley feels that he should. And he's the oldest, and a lot fell on him in terms of carrying around the guilt over what happened with Mom. You know, Dad carries him out of the house and tells him not to open his eyes, and leaves him in charge of the kids when Dad goes back to the house. But maybe he feels a little bit of guilt or he feels a little bit of whatever that is over his role or lack thereof in that. And so as the oldest, maybe he had the ability to perceive what was going on in these people's individual needs, or that he was, as a young child, willing to take that on. If the stomach of the house, if the Red Room was a stomach that was trying to swallow these people by giving them what they wanted, Stephen understood that as a child and was able to participate in that. And maybe that's what he's left behind a little bit as an adult. When he goes and visits Luke in the treehouse, Luke is playing with an E.T. lunchbox, and you can see Henry Thomas on it.
Do you think that, like, in the universe of The Haunting of Hill House, Hugh Crane is like, man, that kid looks a lot like me. Like that could have been me as a child hanging out with E.T.
Yet another ghost that's following him around, right?
It's only he would have been like 30 years old when E.T. came out.
Yeah, that it's fun to think about that sort of thing. Like, and it's fun that the show does a lot of that, layered kind of connection. I already mentioned that the Dr. Montague played Luke in the original movie adaption in The Haunting.
Yeah, and that's Russ Tamblyn, yes. great actor who is Dr. Jacoby on Twin Peaks, spectacular. So this is well-trod material for him, I believe.
And there are other weird things like that throughout. And just like the Sanderson Clinic where Luke goes is the name of Luke's last name in the novel, Luke Sanderson. And so there are just little connections, and there are lines of dialogue. Couple of Stars is a big thing that's from the book that you see throughout this show. The Grannon killing, like there's a horrible poem that's recited at one point. I think it's by Mrs. Dudley. That is something that's recited in the book. There are a lot of those kind of connections throughout that are present in the novel that are little head nods. And I think there are plenty of times where the dialogue is a straight lift, including the monologue about whatever, you know, Hill House not sane stood against. That sort of dialogue is directly from the book, and whatever walked there walked alone is a big line from the book, and certainly, like I said, a big change when at the end of the series is whatever walk there walk together. So certainly something, I don't know, it's just there's a lot of great stuff in this show, and I definitely hope that people who enjoyed the show have enjoyed our podcast about it.
Anything else you want to add, or is that a good place to let this guy lie?
Oh my God. It's terrifying, and I don't want him to make
it's so
more.
Scary.
I don't want him to make more. I want him to stop here. And I certainly think that if this was supposed to be an audition, or if this was proof of concept for Mike Flanagan getting to make other Netflix horror shows, can't wait to see what he
take
would
take me to the Flaniverse,
next.
You know,
yeah, give me the next Flanagan show.
Yeah, I'm in for that. But I would like this to be the end of Haunting of Hill House, especially with Lock and Key on the way. I think, it's just a lot of Haunted House material. Right? Netflix has so many shows. They don't need two Haunted House shows.
They probably already have another Haunted House show that
I'm
we don't
sure
even
that
know
they
about.
Do, and
they probably have two or three other ones. Yeah.
The Norwegian Haunted House show that we have we have flanked on.
Put it in the Bird Box, Josh.
Oh, God. Don't get me started on Bird Box.
I've heard you're causing a stir on Twitter with the Bird Box takes.
The mildest of stirs. All right, well, we're gonna hopefully cause another stir with our next podcast. We are into 2019 already, but we are still looking at shows from 2018. Release schedule TBD, but we have our next show on the docket picked out. Antonio, what are we gonna be talking about next?
Another horror show, maybe, about the horrors of the modern uber rich, if you will, and the people that control our lives at every moment.
Another family drama.
Sure. Your family drama is my horror show. we're going to be talking about HBO's Succession. That is not Secession, and it is not a Showtime show. It is an HBO show, Succession.
Succession. Get your Brian Cox here. I think there's another show that is packed with an incredible array of actors. You can get your obligatory Culkin quota satisfied here in Succession.
We do have that. We definitely have the Culkin quota. I don't know. Is the Culkin quota just one?
Yeah, it's like one for...
Isn't it established in Home Alone, the Culkin quota? And aren't there two Culkins in Home Alone?
There are two Culkins.
So maybe we don't have our Culkin
quota. We don't. Yeah, we're lacking. We need to see Macaulay in season two. Macaulay Culkin. Isn't that his name now?
Yes, Macaulay Culkin. That's his name. He married himself. Is there a...
He just changed his middle name to Macaulay Culkin. So his name is Macaulay Culkin is going to be his legal name in 2019.
Say that again.
Macaulay Culkin is going to be his name.
So he changed his middle name to Macaulay Culkin.
Yes, Culkin's middle name is going to be Macaulay Culkin in 2019 when he legally changes it. So his name will be Macaulay Culkin.
So this didn't actually happen.
No, this is real. I swear that this is legitimate, and you can look it up on the internet.
Why would he?
Whether
do
or
such
not
a,
it actually happens.
Why
is
would he suggest
question,
he but. Do such a thing?
I think that he surrendered the right to change his middle name to the masses, and the masses decided that his middle name should be his current name.
Is this a Twitch thing? Did somebody tip him to do this?
I mean, I'm
is this
twitching,
a Patreon
trying to recap the news. But anyway, Macaulay Culkin is not in Succession, but one of his brothers indeed is in Succession, and we will be talking about him and several others when we talk about Succession in the not too distant future. Anything else, Antonio, about Hill House before we close out?
The Macaulay Culkin middle name thing got me shook. This is like such a 2018, 2019
Macaulay Culkin
thing.
Is the bent neck lady.
How
confirmed.
Is it not named after a corporation at this point?
Macaulay Culkin is the bowler hat.
How is it not Macaulay Pepsi Culkin?
No. Macaulay Culkin.
This is ridiculous. Okay. All right. That's fine.
That's fine. All right. Talk to Antonio about Macaulay Culkin on Twitter at AC Mazzaro. How many Z's? How many R's?
Well, it's AC Macaulay Culkin Mazzaro now with two Z's and one R and Macaulay Culkin in the middle there.
I am at Round Howard. No Macaulay Culkins in my name. That'll do it. See ya. All right, everybody, before we close out our Haunting of Hill House discussion and our last minute left turn into Macaulay Culkin, let's take one last quick second to thank our friends over at TrueCar. Now, every car comes with its share of stories. That ding in your bumper when you nervously picked up a first date, the luxury package you got after a big promotion, or the mileage you saved by riding your bike all summer. While you can't put a price tag on your stories, now with TrueCar, you can at least find out what your car is worth when it's time to sell or trade it in. Just go to TrueCar, simply enter your license plate number, and watch how your car's details pop up. then answer a few questions. Navigation and moonroof. Watch as they bump up your value. High mileage? You already knew it was going to cost you, but now you know how much it dings your wallet so you can plan ahead. Once you're finished, you'll get a true cash offer sent in minutes, which you can take to a local certified dealer to cash out or trade in. So when you're ready to experience a better way to sell or trade in your car, check out TrueCar today. True cash offer not available in all states.